From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Julie Glenn. We're sitting down today with award-winning author, historian, and journalist James Carroll. Carroll is a Roman Catholic reformer. He has written extensively over his nearly 50-year career about his experiences in the seminary and as a priest. He's published novels, books on religion and history, and has written many articles and essays, often for The New Yorker. His most recent novel is The Cloister. He won the National Book Award in 1996 for An American Requiem. He lectures widely, both in the United States and abroad, and lives in Boston with his wife, the writer Alexandra Marshall. He was in town for two speaking engagements, one as part of Florida Gulf Coast University's Provost Lecture Series called Nationalism, Tribalism, Divisiveness, Etc., and another speech for the Naples Discussion Group called A History of Hate, from Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia to White Supremacy and Contempt for Immigrants. So we brought him in the studio for a conversation about his life and work and his reflections on the world today. Before we hear that, though, a quick note. You may have noticed that we're changing the show's name to Gulf Coast Life. We've been transitioning to a mostly pre-tape model over the past 6 months or so, so we felt it was time that the name more accurately reflected what we're doing. And now, author, historian, and journalist, James Carroll. James Carroll, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you.
You can engage with the show and other listeners about this conversation with Mr. Carroll on Facebook. We are at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So your talks are titled Nationalism, Tribalism, Divisiveness, Etc., and A History of Hate, from Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia to White Supremacy and Contempt for Immigrants. You've probably given talks similar to these over the years, but can you reflect on what extra weight these talks have in the current situation right now?
Well, it's a great question because we're living through an astonishing renewal of some very ancient forms of contempt for the other in ways that I suspect most of us, however old we are, didn't expect to see again. It's not just in the United States. We see this phenomenon in Europe. People will remember not so long ago a savage assault against Muslims in New Zealand, the rise of overt anti-Semitism from the right and the left. It was a factor in the recent election in Great Britain. And of course, in our own country now, this terrible sequence of assaults against Jews and Jewish institutions, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh year before last, in New Jersey just a few weeks ago, a kosher grocery store where two people were killed, and so forth, combined with, of course, the alas, longstanding tradition of contempt for African Americans in our country and now immigrants. So it's a broad mix of resentment and hostility that requires us all to think hard about what it means, where is it coming from, and what do we do about it? It's a real challenge to our politics, of course.
Mm-hmm.
In a democracy, politics is how we deal with a problem like this. And so we find ourselves listening to politicians for signals about how they're dealing with it. So it's a very large question.
So you mentioned about anti-Semitism being on the rise. I did a quick peek before we came in. According to the Anti-Defamation League, there were 1,879 incidents of anti-Semitism in the U.S. in 2018, including more than 1,000 instances of harassment, and a quick look at their tracker of anti-Semitic actions since the 1st of January this year, 2020. There have been 12 instances already reported. And that's after a very violent December, which you just talked about. Today is January 9th, and there have been 12 things reported already to the Anti-Defamation League. So, yeah, 100% on the rise. And in 1991, you wrote History of Christianity, specifically Roman Catholicism, anti-Semitism, and treatment of Jews, called Constantine's Sword, the Church and the Jews. And I think this is the question that's been nagging at me as these anti-Semitic things keep bubbling up and keep happening. Where did this come from?
Well, it's a great and very important question. Anti-Semitism is deep in the structure of the Western imagination. And obviously, even though the roots of it are complicated, the most important and largest source of contempt for Jews in the West begins with Christianity. Christianity has grown from a Jewish sect in Palestine 2,000 years ago, led by a Jewish man named Jesus. But tragic consequences in the aftermath of the life of Jesus led some of his followers to denigrate the people of Jesus. So you see that even in the Gospels, where the death of Jesus is attributed more to a group called the Jews than it is to the people who actually killed him, the Romans. Pontius Pilate is rendered in the Gospels as a fairly benign character who thought Jesus was innocent and wanted to release him.
But had to carry out orders.
But, well, the crowd, the Gospels portray the crowd called the Jews insisting on Pilate's crucifying Jesus. Crucify him, crucify him. Christians all over the world will renew this story in Holy Week this coming spring. This story of the death of Jesus at the hands of a group called the Jews infected the Western imagination. You almost could say it's like a distortion of the DNA, or another analogy, it's like a bug in the software. Because down through the centuries, Christians were ready to turn against Jews as the scapegoats, the people on whom to blame any number of negative turns in the history they were experiencing, whether it was an economic downturn or sources of conflict or plagues or terrible new forms of politics and power. Jews are being blamed year in and year out, generation in and generation out. They're the perfect scapegoat people. And the culmination of this tradition, alas, is the Holocaust. The Holocaust was carried out by a relatively small band of Nazis, but the Nazis couldn't have done it without the preceding history of Christian anti-Judaism. And that's what the Christian community has been trying to reckon with since the end of World War II. And we keep thinking that we're finished with it. But then these incidents show up, the demonstration in Charlottesville year before last, mm-hmm. these savage assaults that you referred to at the outset, this way in which when there's stresses in society, economic, political, cultural, Jews are brought forward as the ideal scapegoat. The other thing to have in mind is that anti-Semitism is at the root of other forms of bigotry in the West, especially including white supremacy, the idea that some people are biologically superior to others. That idea begins with the Christian assertion that Jews are biologically inferior to Christians, which is an invention of the late Middle Ages. So what I'm really saying is,
which was another time of economic turmoil.
It certainly was a time
disease.
Of Europe coming into its own, new forms of governance, new forms of transportation, new forms of economic activity, times of transition like that, often stressful. We're living through one now, obviously. What I'm saying is it's what's required is more than being polite or being civic or being tolerant. What's required is a deep work of history. We Christians, I'm a Catholic, we Christians have a serious obligation to revisit our own history, understand much more fully how we lived in ways that did prepare for the Holocaust, and how we're still perpetuating myths about Jesus Christ that are still capable of generating contempt for his own people.
Well, there would be Christians that would say it's in the Bible, it's gospel, right? So they yes. would not consider it to be a myth.
That's true, and it's a very important point because the gospels themselves were written in a period like that of stress, transition, turmoil that did in fact lead to the scaping of Jews. So when we read in the Gospels that the enemy of Jesus are the Jewish people, we're not reading something that's an eyewitness account that actually reports what happened in the lifetime of Jesus. Most Christians don't appreciate the importance of knowing that the Gospels were not written around the time of Jesus or shortly thereafter. Remember that Jesus died in about the year 30. The Gospels were written between 70 and 110 or 120. So almost two generations after Jesus. And in that period, the Romans were waging a savage war against the Jewish people. And the tensions attached to that war sparked, as such wars often do, a civil war among the Jewish people, arguing over what is it to be a Jew. And some answered, to be a Jew is to observe Torah, kosher, Shabbat, the life of the law. And others answered, to be a Jew now is to be a follower of Jesus. And that argument within the Jewish community became polemical, and we see the evidence of that polemic in the Gospels. So what we're getting in the Gospels is a story of conflict, not between Jesus and the Jews, but between two groups of Jews who disagree with each other about Jesus. And that it's important to have that in mind, because what it really boils down to is the Jewish people were not the enemy of Jesus. In fact, the only people who accepted Jesus, who loved him, who clung to his memory, were Jews. And Jesus himself was Jewish. In the Christian memory, he's often portrayed as if he was the first Christian. He wasn't. Jesus lived and died a faithful, we would say, Orthodox Jew, preaching only the God of Israel. We Christians sometimes think there's the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament.
Yeah, they have totally different personalities.
The God of judgment and condemning and wrath, and the God of mercy and love. No, Jesus only preached one God, the God of Israel, who is himself the God of love. So all of the preaching that we associate with Jesus was Jewish preaching. And if we Christians hadn't forgotten that, the history of the last 200 years would be very different.
But it worked for the Roman Empire to have everybody forget that, because it empowered them. I mean, the church wasn't just the church. It was the state.
That's true. Empires often have the effect of dividing the people they've conquered. So the British Empire divides the Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland. The British Empire divides the Hindus and the Muslims in the subcontinent of Asia, Pakistan, India, and so forth. This is the way empires control people, divide and rule. The Roman Empire divided the Jewish people they were ruling over in Palestine. And that division worked for Rome's power. The story takes another turn a century and a half, two centuries later, when the Roman Empire itself becomes Christian with the conversion of the emperor. And at that point, Christians begin to pursue their charges against the Jews with the power of the state. The great leap forward in human history, in my view, on this question came with the American intuition that the separation of church and state was crucial, that state power should be kept apart from religious claims. And the magistrate, the person in charge of the government, should have no control over the conscience of the citizen. That separation of church and state is what prepared the ground in the United States for the liberation of Jews. It's one of the reasons that anti-Semitism was left behind more successfully in America than in most other places. Alas, what we're seeing now is that more ancient tradition, going back to the Roman Empire, of scapegoating Jews when there's trouble, that still lives in us, even in America.
I've had historians on talking, and there are not many other instances in American history when we've been as divided as we are now. I mean, obviously the Civil War, but and other times, but we are very divided. So is that kind of division, and is it possible that political ideology is becoming people's religion almost when they're driven to violence against people, and then again scapegoating the Jews with anti-Semitic rants and actions?
Well, it's true, and it's important for us to step back and remember that as the most treasured thing about a democracy is that unlike monarchies, unlike empires, unlike other forms of government, a democracy is an institution in which people place their trust in politics itself as the way to resolve conflict. In a monarchy, conflict is resolved from above by orders given by the person in charge. In a democracy, conflict is resolved by the interchange of ideas, by checks and balances, as we say. The Constitution is an ingenious arrangement of conflict. Conflicts resolved when one branch of government is checked by another branch of government, and compromise achieved through the system of elections. Well, we're living through a terribly divided time now, but that's why our politics is so important. It's not for nothing that Americans are obsessed in this period with our politics. It's a good thing, and we Americans have a right to have our politicians come before us and be confronted with these problems. The red state, blue state divide seems to paralyze our ability to do that right now. But my own conviction is that the red state, blue state divide isn't the most important thing about us, that we are a people capable of being united, of being ready to work together. In the lifetimes of many people listening to us right now, we recall what the experience of this country was immediately after 9/11, when we were a sorely divided people before that. But there was a period after 9/11 when we all understood that we are one people, and we all flew the flag with pride, and we all could believe in the possible recovery of our nation. Alas, it's too complicated to elaborate, but we as a people, out of the trauma of that assault on 9/11, made terrible choices.
We really did come together after 9/11. I remember it very clearly. I've never seen anything more unified. I mean, I don't care where you lived. They attacked us anywhere. I mean, everybody was just like,
"That's
how did
right."
You do that?
And we should remember that. We should also actually return to that moment and try to understand what went wrong with it. And what did go wrong with it was we made, again, through our politics, some terrible decisions, not the least of which was to embrace unnecessary wars of choice that were
– Yeah, speaking of wars of choice, take us back to what's come up in the last couple of days is the Crusades, the cross of the Crusades. It suddenly has shown up on a photo of Donald Trump Jr. holding an AK-47 with the Crusades cross emblazoned upon it. What's the symbology of that?
Well, it's actually quite a relevant question because this history that I've been talking about took a you might say a terrible turn in the period of the Crusades. Your listeners will remember that the Crusades were a series of holy wars launched effectively by the church between the beginning of the 11th century, the beginning of the 12th century, beginning in 1096 and going on for almost 300 years. Seven or eight crusades, what were they? They were wars of Christian Europe against Islamic occupiers of the Middle East, especially Jerusalem, the Holy Land. And the European Christian community was desperate to retrieve the Holy Land where Jesus had walked from the infidel, the Muslims who occupied it. By the time the Crusades ended, Europe had defined itself positively over against a negative enemy, Islam. And that structure of the European imagination did not go away. It was submerged. It lived below the surface of life. But again, at a time of great stress, 9/11, that structure of the imagination, us against them, us against Islam, surfaced quickly. And it made it very easy for us to make the terrible mistake of accepting Osama bin Laden's invitation to go to war against Muslims, as Muslims, to go to war against, as he put it, the whole house of Islam. He regarded this as a continuation of the Crusades. George W. Bush accidentally referred to this war on terror, as it was called, as a crusade. The Crusades were a great wrong turn in the culture of Europe. And it's not an accident that the first attacks on Jews in Europe, the first pogroms, took place by Crusaders exactly in the same period, in 1097, 1096. So anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, the hatred of Jews, the hatred of Muslims, have gone hand in glove from the beginning. White supremacists, there should be no surprise, have embraced the idea of the Crusades as their emblem. And one of their chief symbols is the Crusader's cross. And it is, I completely agree with you, completely disturbing to see Donald Trump Jr. brandishing an assault rifle with the Crusader's cross on it, not just because it evokes the Crusades, the holy war against Islam, but because it evokes this new contemporary turn on the history when white supremacists have embraced this this ethic of holy war against the infidel. In white supremacist terms, of course, the infidel are people of color.
Does anything surprise you at this point?
Well, because I've studied the history of this dark turn in the human story so deeply, I will admit that what I am surprised by is the regular opportunity we have to correct it. History is not automatically fated. It's not forced on us. And when you go back through the decades and centuries, what you see again and again is that there were forks in the road. There were turning points. There were times when human beings could have gone one way, but they went another. And again, those forks in the road have led to catastrophe, ultimately in this subject, to the Holocaust. But there are other forks in the road. And since the Holocaust, just to take one example that we're talking about, we Christians have found ourselves at a new fork in the road, and we've had to revisit our attitudes toward Jews and Judaism. I was surprised by and filled with hope by the way in which my own Catholic tradition directly confronted its complicity in the Nazi genocide. It did that at the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, and the Second Vatican Council, not too well remembered by your listeners perhaps, but it was so important because this most important, most powerful teaching authority of the Roman Catholic Church issued a formal proclamation renouncing forever the charge that the Jews murdered Jesus, which is where, as we said a few minutes ago, this whole thing began. And that's why the Council Fathers renounced it. And they also renounced the idea that God has rejected the Jewish people. Those two assertions by the Catholic Church were the beginning of the Christianity's recovery from its long tradition of anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. Alas, it was only the beginning. We see very clearly that turn in the story has yet to be completed. But the fact that it happened at all is very hopeful.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with award-winning author, historian, and journalist James Carroll. He's in town for two speaking engagements, one as part of Florida Gulf Coast University's Provost Lecture Series called Nationalism, Tribalism, Divisiveness, etc., and another for the Naples Discussion Group called A History of Hate from Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia to White Supremacy and Contempt for Immigrants. Our conversation is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls, but you can add your thoughts and interact with fellow listeners via social media on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about your life history.
Sure.
And how your trajectory has been. You served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974. So how did the nexus between being a chaplain and writing journalism come about?
Well, I was privileged to be a Catholic priest for 5 years. I trained for the priesthood all through the 1960s. A time of turmoil, upheaval, and great renewal, both in American society and in my own Catholic Church. And by the time I became a priest, my life as a chaplain at a university was taken over by the anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam. I began to write about that. A privilege to find a platform as an anti-war priest. Alas, the effect of the war in my own life was that it undercut some of the basic capacities I had for being a person of the establishment, you might say. Mm-hmm. I found myself a critic, a dissenter, and that turned out not to be the best match for life in the Roman Catholic priesthood.
Did that strain some personal relationships too?
Sure, it did.
Your father, I think, was a military person.
My dad was an American Air Force officer, yeah. A hero, a distinguished general, a pious Catholic. He was disapproving of my decision to leave the priesthood. But he was also basically the man who made me who I am. So if I found myself in conflict with him, it was probably because I was responding to him with the very character he had implanted in me.
Those are tough moments.
Yeah. But I then had the great privilege of going on to a life as a writer. I've lived as a writer in these almost 50 years since.
It's kind of an isolated life, though, sitting there at that time.
Well, right? Yes, and no. I was lucky enough early on, more than 40 years ago, to meet another writer with whom I could share that life, my wife, a novelist, Alexandra Marshall.
That is incredible. In 1996, you won the National Book Award for Nonfiction for your book, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us. It's a memoir about the Vietnam War and the relationship with your dad and the Catholic Church. So if people want to learn more about that, that book is out there. How did that change your trajectory as well, winning that award?
Well, my dad, my mother and father died in the early 1990s. The book was actually, I think, published in 1996. I wrote the book as a way of both processing my grief, but also trying to finish the unfinished business that I had, especially with my dad, over the war and what had come between us. But I most especially wanted to tell the story as much as I could from his point of view, trying to honor his experience. And I learned much more than I ever had known about what it was like to be a serious senior figure in the American military during that tragic war. And I came away from the writing of the book with a much fuller understanding of my father's, well, I'll use the word, my father's integrity and nobility, which underscores my own, even though I am a dissenting and in some ways radical American citizen, it still underscores my deep sense of patriotism.
Mm-hmm. That is all the time that we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest, James Carroll, an award-winning author, historian, journalist. He's in Southwest Florida for two speaking engagements, one as part of Florida Gulf Coast University's Provost Lecture Series called Nationalism, Tribalism, Divisiveness, etc., and the other for the Naples discussion group called A History of Hate, from Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia to White Supremacy and Contempt for Immigrants. James Carroll, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
My privilege. Thank you.
If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. Or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. You may have noticed at the beginning of the show today that we have officially changed the show's name to Gulf Coast Life. We've transitioned it to a mostly pre-taped model over the past 6 months or so, so we felt it was time that the name more accurately reflected what we're doing. Our show today is produced by Mike Canary. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.